Were any of your formative crushes cartoon characters? Are any of your current crushes cartoon characters? If so, welcome to my happy place. I'm comedy writer and 41-year-old child, Gabby Hutchison Crouch, and I am an absolute fool for a nicely drawn character. Why? I don't know. Let's find out with the help of some funny guests who are here for a chat about the animated characters that make bits of scenery come alive and sing to them about how in love they are. Will we find something out about early crushes, pop culture and sexuality, or will we just happily sigh thinking about Penelope Pitstop's leotard? Whatever we do, I hope it'll help you see that those thoughts you get about whether Jack Skellington has a literal boner down there are absolutely fine. Welcome to Curiously Drawn. With me this episode is a BAFTA-nominated comedy writer and non-BAFTA-nominated actor and comedian. He is the lead writer on The MASH Report and the writer and star of Radio 4's The Hauntening. One time he showed up for a job I was also writing on while accidentally dressed exactly the same as Matt Bainton in a massive promo mural for The Wrong Mans that was plastered all over the stairwell. It's Tom Neenan. Hello, Tom.
Hello. It was not deliberate. I'm a big fan of Matthew Bainton and his oeuvre, but in this instance, that was just a pure coincidence.
Especially since I think his character in The Wrong Mans is meant to be a bit of a nerd. Like,
oh, yeah.
You came accidentally dressed as somebody who had been deliberately dressed as a loser.
Hey, you've got to have a signature look. That's what I say. Yeah. I've also just looked up online, and basically, if you Google The Wrong Mans, it's basically the first image that comes up is Matthew Bainton in like a lovely Paddington Bear style.
It was exactly the same coat. It was shocking.
It was really terrifying.
And it was huge. It was in the stairwell. It was in a place called Grafton House. And if you're listening and you've ever seen the sitcom W1A, the BBC absolutely is like that, and it's very into like putting up murals. They named everything in that room. There was a tiny little meeting room called Alan Partridge, which is where you had to do your pitching. Yeah. And just the urge to say monkey tennis was massive. 10 foot, like the murals were huge. It was a 10 foot tall Alan Partridge glaring over you. I had a panic attack in Alan Partridge once, which was not fun. Yeah.
It also had nothing to do with the fact that that building smelled of gas for a whole year.
It constantly smelled of gas. I assume it still does. It's since been sold to some, because it's in London, you know, and BBC just gets rid of all of its buildings. Yes. It was a lovely building. It was nice to have a space for comedy, which we don't really do anymore.
Yeah.
These days we get sort of stuck in this weird Cold War themed room with a painting of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is not conducive to comedy.
Yeah.
But also we're next door to the BBC has deliberately got in people to like watch other state media, especially from the naughty countries like Iran, North Korea, Russia, and to just sort of keep tabs on what old Mr. Putin's up to. And we were right next door to the Russians, and we were like, we'd always be like trying to tell each other jokes, and obviously you're pinging jokes off each other, so you're wanting to like laugh and stuff.
Yeah.
And we kept getting like this very dour Russian man coming in and going, please, please stop this laughter. We are listening to Vladimir Putin.
Well, you and I as well, I think you and I are, there are many others, but are particularly guilty of, you know, properly enjoying a good laugh when you're writing, which is, you know, not being unprofessional, but rather going, we're supporting each other with laughter. But often either you or I will have someone come along the corridor and say, oh, I knew you were in because I heard you down the corridor. I feel very bad about that. You're like, oh, okay. But hey, as long as you're working, as long as you're getting the job done.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I think Gareth Gwynne's got the best laugh.
Lovely Gareth Gwynne laugh.
Lovely Gareth Gwynne.
Yeah. It's an absolute nice privilege.
He's a cuddle of a man.
Very nice.
Yeah, I have to get him on this.
Another duffel coat wearer as well. So that is
duffel coat boys. Oh yes, choice one is, I'll tell you what the link is here, because we occasionally meet up for drinks, some comedy writers, and like at the times that we've met up for drinks, Tom keeps asking me if I've seen this show, and I keep to say, no, I haven't. I really need to see this show. It sounds so up my street. And I have now watched some clips to get, because I like to get little sound clips in to pepper our chat.
Oh, lovely. Yeah,
so
yeah.
I've been sort of watching for clips, and just watching it was like, holy shit. I really, this is basically this. I may as well have pitched this show. It's so up my street. I may as well have been the one who went to Paramount or whoever owns the rights and went, guys, I've got this great idea. I've got a favourite from, like, watching 5 minutes of clips already. Yeah, it's the dweeb. Of course it's the dweeb, but we're not talking about the dweeb in this one. Right, so choice one is from a show that I still amazingly have not yet seen, despite it being so up my street that I may as well have pitched it myself. And Tom is constantly shocked and horrified when I tell him that I haven't got around to watching it because he's my friend and he knows what I like.
Yes.
So she is the rebellious pansexual Starfleet ensign who'd rather have little adventures with her little mates than rise up through the ranks, even though, or maybe because, her boss is also her mum. She's one of the few Star Trek red shirts who hasn't died. She's Beckett Mariner from Star Trek Lower Decks. Tom, I've seen little bits of Beckett, but please tell me, sell this show to me more so that I give my money to it's Amazon, isn't it, that's got it in the UK. So so get me to give my precious money to that space bothering prick.
Well, there you go. You're already halfway to space. I think Lower Decks, I'm not a huge Star Trek fan, I hate to admit. I sort of, you know, I'm aware of it and I can dip into you know, their episodes if they are on, and I sort of have I'm on nodding terms with most of the sort of cast and characters. So I don't know. Actually, Lower Decks is the first Star Trek property, apart from the sort of J.J. Abrams and then on movies, which I've engaged with completely and seen every episode of. So I don't know how popular it is with sort of Star Trek fans, but I think it's super fun. And it is, like you say, it's being criticised a bit because I've seen there's been a lot of online discourse about sort of, in inverted commas, adult animation and how they all look a bit the same.
It's the Alistair Beckett King little video that we've both seen, which is brilliant, which in fairness is a brilliant takeoff, mostly of Family Guy.
Well, I think what happened was, and I don't know a lot about the ins and outs of the economics of animation, but basically it seems like Family Guy found a way of producing a style of animation that is super quick to animate and sort of looks fine. And so now it's been replicated over and over again with things like Paradise PD and I guess like The Cleveland Show and American Dad, obviously, that are all part of the same family. And I would say that, like, a bit of the aesthetic of Lower Decks owes a lot to Rick and Morty as well. And maybe a bit of the sense of humour as well. But I think because it's also Star Trek, it's a proper Star Trek owned, like, piece of work, that you do have the Gene Roddenberry kind of positivity, I guess, you know, sort of hung over the top of it. Whereas I would argue that something like Rick and Morty is a bit more nihilistic in its outlook.
Yeah, definitely. Rick and Morty is like the anti-Star Trek.
Basically, you've got, on the one hand, you've almost got something which is deconstructing the whole idea of space travel and how it's basically a selfish endeavour. And obviously, Star Trek is all about, like, humanity progressing, whereas, Rick and Morty can just, like, they say, oh, there's a billion versions of us in different universes, so you can die at any point and no one really cares, which is, like you say, antithetical to the whole idea of Star Trek.
Yeah, and Rick and Morty is really about one guy who's a prick, who puts his family's life in danger so that he can save them. It is about just one guy who's an absolute arsehole. Whereas Star Trek's always been so idealistic. Yes. And I do love it for that. You see, I am a huge Star Trek fan, and I love the universe. I love it. Yep. It's one of my two happy places. My other happy place is the Discworld. It is like a big, sprawling fantasy world where there's lots of parts of it. And it's just, both of those worlds were created by somebody who had very grand ideas about what humans are capable of and the love that humans are capable of and the idea of a better world. And they were both very egalitarian. They both had these wonderful ideas for a world which is not perfect. Yeah. Neither the Star Trek world or the Discworld are perfect, but they are full of people who are trying.
And yes, exactly.
At the core of it, there is a real empathy for all. Mm-hmm. Sorry, that's just been me just talking about what I love about Star Trek. Why don't you tell me what you love about Beckett?
Of course. So basically, I think it's helpful because it sort of lays the foundation of what the show is. And then because it is quite new as well, I get that a lot of people will be looking sort of to their childhood. But I was just thinking, and it's weird because I think the thing that's amazing about Beckett is she's basically, I guess, the relationship that she has with her with Boimler, who's the kind of the dweeb in the show.
He's already my favourite.
He's great.
I'm such an asshole. I'm an absolute a fool for a dick.
And he's like, you know, there's elements of Arnold Rimmer going on with him because he's desperate to rise up the ranks. And there's other elements like this. There's an amazing episode where basically he wants to nail this, like, sort of like a Kobayashi Maru style, like, training exercise that he's desperate to get 100% on. It's the episode is like, his subplot is just him redoing this task over and over again until he gets it to 100%. And of course, because he's the loser, he sort of half manages it. And then circumstances get in the way and sort of ruin it for him. But, like, I think that for me as well, like, obviously, I occupy that lovely time where maybe sort of if I was 10 years younger and they were making a live-action version of Lower Decks, you know, I'd like to think I'd be in the running for Boimler. So I sort of know where I am in the stratosphere. And so he's got purple hair, which is cool. But, like, and so what you've got then is you've got this friendship. They sort of do a bit of will they, won't they, which is cool. But, like, they don't over-egg it in a way that a lot of other shows would. So you've got this really cool friendship between, this guy who thinks that whose idea of Star Trek is to rise up the ranks, and he wants to be on the bridge and he wants to be a captain. And then you've got this person who, her mum is a captain, so she sort of already has access to that world and realises that it isn't as glamorous or as aspirational as you think it is. And so her interest is like, well, we've got the ability to, like, explore the universe, and why would I waste my time trying to, you know, sort of get through the, you know, basically rise through the ranks when I have the universe at my disposal and wants to have adventures. And so you've got this really cool character who is sort of designed in that way. You know, when, like, Star Trek suddenly, around the time of, like, Seven of Nine in Voyager, they suddenly realize that, like, obviously there's always been very, like, you know, attractive and sexy characters in Star Trek. But then they were like, oh, we're not going to even, like, you're not going to have to do any work. We're just going to present you with someone like this who has sort of got these preternatural sort of, measurements and stuff.
Sure.
And just looks kind of, you know, very overtly sexual.
Yeah.
In a kind of like, who's the artist? Like, is it Varga, who sort of draws women in the 50s in a very sort of extreme way? So from then on, you've had, like, Seven of Nine. You've had, who was the Vulcan lady who was in... what was it? Was it not Enterprise?
Oh, in Enterprise. I don't know. I wasn't watching by that point because it was all a bit blah.
It was T'Pol. And she was Jolene Blalock, I want to say. I'm sorry if I pronounced that wrong. But yeah, so she was someone else who just sort of had these sort of ridiculous
super sexy
proportions. Yeah. Yes, exactly. They've scaled that back for this, which I prefer because there's something a bit, I don't know, you know, certainly I think it's called fan service, isn't it? It's that sort of what we're looking at. Whereas this, I feel like they've sort of scaled all that back. So what you have with this character is like, what you have with Beckett is you have this sort of, she looks very cool and she looks very sexy and obviously she's sort of very athletic because she wants to explore the world. But also she just looks like, apart from the big eyes, which are part and parcel of making a cartoon.
Yeah.
She's less sexualized and more just about being cool and being excitable. And I find that, more appealing in a way because it's just someone who is, who's sort of really excitable and wants to seek out danger and all those things. That and the fact that they've animated her in a way where she's often got a ponytail and it has a really cool bounce to it.
Yeah, she has got lovely bouncy hair.
Yes, exactly. And I really like that. I like the fact that they've put effort into, like, that, you know, animating that so she looks really cool. And I think that's like, you know, there's a lot of those where going back to childhood as well, where, you know, I think it was a certainly tropey, but to have like a young woman who is just desperate to escape the bonds of what society expects of her and wants to get muddy and wants to get sort of, you know, wants to get into fights and get into danger and all those things. And I think those are all like, those exist all through, you know, all through our lives, those kinds of people. And it's, I think there's always something appealing about them. I'm trying to think of some like children's ones now. It seems like there's a plenty.
I mean, you're kind of describing Deanna Troi in a way, because she's literally a space princess.
Yeah.
And she is slumming it. She's, you know, every time her mum shows up, her mum's like, honey, you're slumming it. And she's like, no, I'm having fun having space adventures and changing the world, and it's fine. So Starfleet's got like a whole bunch of like their version of army brats. Like I'm very 90s Trek. So Wesley, Jake Sisko, even Geordi and Riker were our army brats Starfleet. So she's one of, but she sort of has this weird sort of hinterland. So like, Geordi, especially Riker was so, from being an army brat, was so driven to become a captain. That was his whole thing. And Jake Sisko was like, nah, dude, I'm going to become a poet. He becomes a writer. I can't remember what kind. I think he becomes like a journalist, but he's like into poetry as well. It's like, nope, Starfleet's not for me. I'm going to dick about and write. She's in a sort of weird sort of hinterland where she hasn't rejected Starfleet completely. And she's not, I want to be like mummy and daddy, like Riker was. But she's just like, she's found this sort of nice kind of middle way where she can still have space adventures, but it's not like, pressure's not on.
Whoa, look at Brad Boimler being cool for once. Wait, is this because of my teachings?
Okay, you don't teach, you just instigate chaos.
Exactly, helpful character building chaos.
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Oh, Boims. I thought you were going to get stuck in middle management, like this pathetic little fly in amber. Like Ransom.
I am not a little fly in amber.
What did it, huh? My constant mockery, my nonstop prodding, my downright dangerous hazing.
No. Look, if you have to know, I found out about your secret.
You mean never eating after 7? It's a miracle, right? I mean, it does work. You should try it.
Captain Freeman is your mom.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, come on, Mariner. The captain's your mom. Your dad's an admiral. You're basically Starfleet royalty. I mean, how cool is that?
Shut the f*** up right now, Boimler. Shut your f*** mouth.
This is a good thing. Now we can both do some good, and you'll just, you know,
keep us out of trouble with your mom.
What? No, that is not how...
I just don't understand why it's such a secret. I'd be telling everyone.
Dude, I don't want people knowing my mom is my mom.
Well, exactly. And what they don't do, which is I get the necessity of film writing, I guess, is like in the most recent sort of J.J. Abrams iterations, Kirk, obviously his father dies in the sort of when it's attacked. And then he sort of carries this burden with him about what it is to be a leader. And that clearly sort of it conflicts him. Whereas what's really nice about this, because it's a cartoon and it's lighter and it doesn't have sort of a big filmic narrative to bear the weight of, she can sort of, like you say, it's just a lighter character. She's not actually, there's fun dynamics and fun conflicts there, but she isn't a character who is bearing the weight of enormous trauma or enormous responsibility as much. Almost she's like shunning that. And that's really nice and really refreshing.
That is really nice, because so many Star Trek characters have just had such a shit life. Everyone in TNG is like huge amounts of trauma, and you know, Sisko lost his wife to the Borg attack, and
it's a lot. Whereas this is, like you say, I guess as well, because it's Lower Decks and because it represents the people who are, you know, aren't on the bridge. They're the people. They're the red shirts who would who would usually sort of go down the planet and get killed first. Mm-hmm. They haven't lived long enough to accrue much trauma. which is always nice. It means that you are inherently dealing with people who have more fun. Whereas on the upper decks, you have I don't have all the characters' names, but there's a guy who's sort of a warrior and has like a massive scar down his his face, and it's meant to obviously he's meant to represent someone who's been through the wars and everything else, and all these younger people have aspirations, but they haven't suffered, which is, I think, I don't know, it makes it a lot more fun. I think it's a really cool way of freshening up that series. I kind of wish as well that, like, I don't know, maybe we'll see this. I'm a big Doctor Who fan, and I'd love it if there was an avenue for Doctor Who to have like this kind of cartoon spin-off of something. I don't know what.
I think Spin-off Central is a coming.
I think you're right.
With the return of Daddy Rusty.
Exactly. I really hope so, because, like, apart from anything else, I you know, it would be a very cool way of just having a bit more Doctor Who, even if it was, you know, a something set on Gallifrey or something that just was, yeah, you know, was really fun. But it means that you can have different flavors, which I guess they also did with Torchwood and the Sarah Jane Adventures.
Getting back to this, apparently, yeah, just from what I can see, this is basically, they're in my era. They're in that sort of 90s. Uh-huh. It's the sort of the 90s time. Well, for us, the 90s time, which for them is about 90 years after TOS.
Right. Okay, yes.
Uh-huh. Is that right? Because it looks like she's got relationships with both Worf and Riker. Sort of, she's, yes, met them both. So this kind of sounds like it's my kind of, I think, the kind, so, of era, yeah, that I really get into. Things.
But what I like as well is it's not the, there's not too much, the canon is like dealt with very lightly. And, yeah, so you can sort of, yeah, you can sort of dive in, and there's fun little nods every now and again. Like they'll talk about, they'll talk about the original Enterprise, you know, flight, and someone will say like, oh, there've been a long road getting from there to here. And like little things that are just like little touches to it. But I guess like, well, I don't know how this will compare to other episodes, but like what I haven't gone for is anthropomorphized animals. I can't square that circle. I'm so sorry.
We've got a lot of anthropomorphized animals.
I thought I'd try. What I'm trying to do here is sort of go, oh, these are a sort of cartoon characters who are sort of aspirational and also really cool. And you could imagine, like, oh my God, how amazing would it be to be around these people? And
yeah.
So, so that's sort of my way into this, as opposed to being like, I had strange feelings towards Robin Hood, which is absolutely valid.
Fine. Yeah.
but I can't quite, you know, something in my own head, I'm just like, okay, that exists in this separate world. Whereas, yeah, here, you're like, I would love to turn up in Lower Decks or something and, yeah, actually sort of meet these people in their cartoon world. So that's sort of how I've approached it anyway. So yeah, so my first... That's why my first choice is Beckett.
Excellent.
Barrett.
And I just
want to, cool.
Yeah, and I just want to add in, because I am putting, I'm going to put in a klaxon for when this happens in canon. She is a canon pansexual.
Ah, there you go. Very,
canon,
very
pansexual nice. Klaxon.
Yay. Put in a sound effect there. I think actually, I've almost gone, dear God, let's not examine this too far, but I think I've almost exclusively chosen dual heritage pansexuals as my choices.
Excellent. Yes, I think you have.
Yeah. Also, you know, there's a lot of things that I really like. For instance, in her character design, they've designed it so she's almost permanently got an arched eyebrow and very cool eye makeup as well. This, yeah, is sort of very cool. Yeah, very cool cat eyes that they've kind of subtly done as well. But like I say, I don't feel like she's been designed. I don't think she, you know, that the male gaze has been overworked here.
No.
Yeah, which is quite comforting.
Yes. Well, let's move on to choice two, who is another pansexual woman of dual heritage. I'm not going to have to work hard with the links. Choice two is a mother, a lover, and accidentally one of the best spies in the world, to the disappointment of her parents, who wanted her to be a nice liberal academic. Her taste in mini dresses is very knitwear heavy. Her taste in men is the absolute worst. Welcome to the danger zone. It's the constantly despairing field agent, Lana Kane from Archer. Right,
no.
I yes. love Archer and I love Lana, but please, first of all, there's a lot of kick-ass women on your list.
Yes.
Second of all, talk us through what you love about Lana.
Okay, well, first of all, Lana could be like a Beckett Mariner, like almost if she was born in a different era and she was born in the 50s, then your Beckett Mariner would maybe have become a Lana Kane. There are similarities. But I think that what I really like about Lana, one, is that she feels very, well, first of all, is the fact that she, you always have to look at the voice cast as well. I think it's very important.
Yes.
Aisha Taylor is objectively one of the coolest people alive. She has been in, you know, she was obviously in Friends. She hosts Whose Line Is It Anyway? And she is, she's sort of an amazing podcaster as well and things like that. I just think she's absolutely brilliant. So you got, starting off, you got someone who's an amazing voice actor playing them. Then,
yeah,
Lana Kane herself is a kick-ass spy. She is trained in martial arts. She is incredibly smart. She looks incredible. Once again, I think the male gaze is slightly amped up.
Yes, it is a lot more. It's massive. It's massive woman in a constantly in a mini dress with huge tits. as a bisexual woman is there for the queer female gaze as well.
Fair enough. So there you go. We won't, you know, claim all of it. And it's so I think it's very cool. And Archer as a TV show itself is like it deals. I think it's very like sex positive show.
Yes.
It also deals with like. There's a character who is in a wheelchair who, like, what I really like about that is there's a character who is injured and is in a wheelchair, but, like, that isn't the next episode, they're not fine again. Like, they, you know, that character then will spend the next few series in a wheelchair. And it's, like, actually dealing with some realities, even though it's ridiculous and it's about a super spy and it sort of lives in this weird world where they have laptops, but it's 100% like the late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah, they're in this hinterland between 1950 and now, and you're never quite sure when it is because the aesthetics are all over the place, and I love that.
Yeah, yeah. And also, like, sometimes it's the 80s as well, isn't it? Like, there's a whole series, it's like Miami Vice. But it's like, I think that the relationship between Lana Kane and Archer is like it's the perfect relationship for a spy and his on again, off again girlfriend, where they sort of hate each other, yet clearly, because they're both incredibly sexy, they cannot resist, you know, spending time with each other and getting back together and obviously having a kid together and things like that. And
also, they're both psychopaths.
Yeah.
They are both. Absolutely mad.
What? No, do not wind her up. That is a big gun, and she is baby crazy.
Baby crazy?
That's why I dumped her.
You sack of shit! I dumped you because you're dragging around a 35-year-old umbilical cord!
See? All you talk about is baby shit!
And I think just the whole ensemble... I mean, Lana is the most sensible one... But she is not sensible.
Not at all.
That is like, she's just about capable of feeling empathy. Whereas everybody else, one of the things I love about Archer is that it lets the women be monsters as well. They are not victims at all. They are assholes. They are various assholes. I love Pam. Pam is one of my favorites.
Oh, she's incredible.
Because she's fat and she is very
sexy as well. Like, they do not
very sexy.
She is, you know, she is very sort of, once again, someone who is very sexually active, and also, like, you know, there's a weird thing with Archer. There's so much nudity in it, but it's all, I guess, and, you know, it's you know, tasteful in inverted commas. But you know, that, and she's not, she's, you know, got incredible body confidence and stuff. And you're like, well, that's so cool. That's such a cool thing to see. And like, it's a weird thing where also they don't ignore the fact that people like that do experience prejudice. And Archer is obviously a bit of a body fascist because he's, you know, he's a psychopath in every other sense of the word.
Mm.
But like, she gives as good as she gets as well, and like responds to it and doesn't care. And
yeah,
I think at
she
the time,
doesn't care. And they have sex. Everyone has sex in this show. Everyone has sex with everybody else, which is why everybody in this show is a pansexual. Because they've all fucked each other.
Yeah.
And they are, Archer and Pam do have an affair for a while, and it is just the best sex that he has ever had.
Yeah.
And she's like, you're okay, but I'm not going to lose any sleep over it.
Yes, exactly. And like, obviously, yeah, like you say, everyone in the show is so broken and everyone is so damaged. Mm. And you see Jessica Walter is as Mallory is like, she's
so
playing...
Good.
You know, she's playing a version of a sort of more professional and more competent version of what she does in Arrested Development, where it's just like this absolutely cold mother.
Yeah.
But who ultimately you never don't think wants the best for her son, even though she knows her son is an absolute arsehole, like, all the time. And I think that, once again, when you're watching Archie, you're watching this, like you say, incredibly sexualized world, because it is all about Bond and it is all sort of this 50s aesthetic and stuff. But you don't see, like you say, nobody comes across as the victim. And it's they actually, the twist it has on Bond is that it's like if the Bond girl was able to have as equal amount of like time sparring with Bond and have as many quips and as many jokes and as many other things. And I think that's what's really cool about it. It makes it so much fun to watch.
Yeah, they all have quips. They all have their own catchphrases and things. Lana's is nope.
It's brilliant. Her signature, I mean, like, what's also great is that often cartoons will default a character to a uniform. Obviously, with Lower Decks, that is, you know, that's natural because they all wear uniforms. But sometimes, obviously, like the Simpsons things make a virtue of the fact that the characters never change. Sure. Whereas actually, while we sort of associate, like you say, Lana Kane is known for her heavy knitwears and her, like, roll necks and things like that, they do also, they mix it up a lot. So she
does change colour a lot.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I like that. I like the fact that it makes them feel more like real people. And, yeah. You know, Lana does feel like a real person. Like I say, you've got Aisha Taylor's voice, which is incredible, which is like dripping with sarcasm and like absolute disdain for Archer. And it's, you know, I think everyone, obviously, is it John H. Benjamin. Who's got the coolest voice ever.
He does.
And it's weird how that is it's adaptable because he's incredibly cool as Archer and he doesn't do much, but he's incredibly browbeaten as Bob.
It's the same voice. It's exactly, he puts on the same, I think that's just his voice that he puts on for Archer, this incredibly sexy psychopath, yeah. And Bob Belcher, who's one of the kindest, sweetest, this sort of working class man who adores his family and adores his job flipping burgers.
Yeah.
It's the same voice for these polar opposites and they both work.
It's mad, isn't it? It's absolutely mad. It's sort of a bit the way that, I mean, because what's strange though is because obviously in the past there have been people like, I remember David Jason would obviously be Danger Mouse. And then he was, if you ever saw the animated Wind in the Willows series, which is incredible, it's so beautiful. And obviously he's playing Toad there where he's like very posh and very sort of, you know, seemingly high status. And then he can be Del Boy. But obviously what he's doing there is the accent is changing. So you can sort of delineating between those. What we've got here is two men at the opposite ends of all the different spectrums. Yeah. And it's incredible that they both, like you say, they both work. I don't know, he's got this incredible voice, which I guess is something only Americans can do because a lot of American voices we perceive as being classless, even though I'm sure actually if you knew more about them, there's a lot of history and stuff embedded in it. But I just think I think he's incredible, and I think the whole cast is brilliant. Who is it?
Really good. Who haven't we mentioned yet?
Who's the billionaire-ess who is the secretary?
She's sometimes called Cheryl and she's sometimes called Carol. To the point that it started off as a joke where Archer couldn't remember her name, and then because she's probably the maddest one out of all of them. She starts forgetting what her own name is. So sometimes she refers to herself for Cheryl and sometimes she refers to herself as Carol because she sort of started off where the joke was she was like an interchangeable pretty girl who he's always messing about and she's always sad about it, and it's like, no, what if this girl is out psychopaths all of them?
She is
so dangerous, she is so violent, and she will kill someone just because she's bored.
I think that's why she couldn't be on the list, because you wouldn't actually want to spend any time with her. Like, I think she's sort of made up to be the most, you know, she's like, I guess, the, in inverted commas, prettiest, designed that, you know, designed to be the prettiest, but is aware of that and then uses that to sort of manipulate people and then also prove that she is absolutely unhinged. Yeah. Judy Greer, isn't it? Judy Greer.
Yeah, I love that Pam's nickname for her is Neck Bones.
It makes a lot of sense. It's brilliant. And then obviously there's Chris Parnell as Cyril Vegas.
Again, doing the same voice that he does in all the things.
And they, because actually Archer allows its characters to evolve, I think that him as, who's the dad in Rick and Morty? Jerry.
Yeah.
Like, he's, you know, that's the same voice that he uses for Jerry. And I think that they wanted Cyril originally was very much the beater and had more of a Jerry energy. But then they all, because it's Archer, they also allow him to, like, he has an affair with...
He's an asshole.
Yeah.
He's a real asshole.
Exactly. And they allow... So everyone... It feels like every character is they're able to turn them and explore them and do a bit, you know, do a bit more. And I really like that. And like you say, Chris Parnell... I mean, that voice is incredible as well. That is just...
Yeah, and they also... The Kruger... the guy who's always a mad scientist and almost certainly a clone of Hitler. We think he might be a clone of Hitler because he grew up in like a lab in Argentina.
Oh yeah.
but he's got a sweetness to him, even though he is really scary.
It's so, and I guess like it's what you get when you have like, what is it now, like 7 seasons of Archer where...
10, I think.
You can tell, oh my God.
Well, they had 3 seasons that didn't count because they had 3 seasons where he was in a coma and it was different dreams that had no stakes in the real world at all, and I got a bit pissed off with it. But the last season, the last season is back in the real world and it does have some real stakes to it, which is good.
Great, that's good. Yeah, I think it's such a cool series. And like, who wouldn't fancy like basically everyone in that series? Because it's this sort of morally flexible world where everything is sort of hypersexualized and hyperviolent, and you're like, well, that's so cool. And that's what you can do in cartoons as well.
Yeah,
I think second that you actually brought any of this into the real world, you wouldn't like the characters as much. And you wouldn't, I don't know that you'd find anyone as, you'd find them as charming as you do when you're looking at these, you know, the animations. Apart from anything else, like, H. John Benjamin doesn't look like Archer, sadly. He's a very cool guy, you know, he's a very lovely looking man, but Archer has this, like, this sort of steely chiseledness, but also this weird, like, vacant stare of a man who is very smart, but also very stupid. brilliant character design, it's very cool.
I think they're all based on real people. I think I think they've all got real models in the real world that they just sort of based them on.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's move on to another pansexual woman of dual heritage.
I'm assuming there. I assume.
I mean, she's. I don't think they're coded white anyway. Let's just say, but she's also not straight. So Joyce 3 is the only character we've had on before so far, but I'm allowing her again because I think it'll be interesting talking about her from a man's point of view, because we have had a woman talking about her and seeing her as like a little baby bi crush. So again. Let's welcome the last word in 90s artsy cool. She looks like a doodle in an indie kids school notebook. It's Jane Lane again from Daria. Yay! So, yeah, I did talk about Jane with Shandoxy. And she described her three choices as aggressively bisexual. So we both had a talk about 90s cartoons and being a bi lady. But why don't you talk me through what you like about Jane?
Sure. I mean, like, once again, I'll start by sort of looking at the show as a whole and sort of saying that what I love about Daria and what I think is so cool about it is that it is about being honest and about not compromising or not sort of pretending that you're, you know, not. It's about being unashamedly who you are. It's a load of characters who are, are proudly who they want to be. And I think almost there's no one who represents that more than Jane. Who is an artist and is like it's the same it's almost the same idea they had with Frasier, which is you know how you have like Frasier, he's very pompous, and then they were like, well, how do we make that seem more extreme? Well, we give him a brother who's even more pompous,
even
than
more.
He is. Which like is such a smart move, and I think
that character type is called the Niles, isn't it? When you get a character and then. When that character, you want to make that character seem like their main trope is like lesser and make this more random. Yeah. You just get in a character, the Niles, who is that character, but more so.
Makes sense. And I think that's almost what they did with Daria, is they had Daria, who is incredibly cynical. And then actually you've got Jane, who is cynical as well, but wears it differently. And I think wears it smarter than Daria does a lot of the time. And she's got this. I love the hair, first of all. It's the absolute opposite of Beckett Mariner. That hair is not moving. That is. It is.
It's like a knife.
Exactly. And it's, you know, it's got that. It's got the asymmetry, which is very cool. That is, asymmetrical haircuts are obviously incredibly cool, and it's very subtle. But I think that's brilliant. And she carries herself with this like. It's weird because it is a real confidence.
I just want to say how proud I am today. Knowing that I have self-esteem gives me even more self-esteem. On the other hand, having all of you know that I had low self-esteem makes me feel kind of bad, like a big failure or something. I want to go home.
So, like, you've got the big boots and you've got the baggy shirt that she wears and stuff, but it's all just worn with this effortlessness. And I think at the time that I was probably watching Daria, it's a time when you sort of want to feel comforted that you're, that, you know, the stuff that means that you're not I don't know, you know, you don't fit in as much, or nobody fits in when they're younger. That's the myth that everyone doesn't realise, is that everyone's trying and everyone's failing. Is that there, you can do that and actually be unapologetic about it, and it can all be fine. And I think that that's what she represents for me, is just this time when you're like, oh no, it's okay. She has this like smirk as well occasionally. She doesn't smile a lot, as no one really does in Daria, but every now she's actually will allow herself a smirk every now and again. And I think that that's just what makes her brilliant, and would absolutely, if I was at high school with her, want to be her friend, definitely.
Oh God, yeah, I would. Well, I mean, if it was the mid-90s and I was at school with her, I'd want to be her friend, but I'd also have some funny tummy feelings that I didn't quite understand. It was the middle of Section 28 and I wouldn't be able to talk about it. I think it's really interesting that when I started this podcast, I had ideas about who the popular choices would be. Right. The Fox, who has come up, Robin Hood Foxman. But I also thought that I assumed that the people who fancy women would be going for like more sort of hypersexualized Caramel Bunny and Jessica Rabbit and stuff like that. I think it's really interesting that the most popular one has been this snarky teenager. It's just a really interesting thing that's come up. I think maybe that's just the generation that are my friends. So we're all of a certain age and we work in the arts, whether like we all just really fucking love Jane Lane.
I think it would be tricky to choose the Caramel Bunny part, because I'm not sure about this. I've had an argument with someone. I thought that Jan Ravens was at some point the voice of the Caramel Bunny, and I've worked with Jan Ravens and I know her son quite well. So I think that would be that would feel awkward. But then a lot of people say no.
It was Miriam Margolyes.
So I heard that all the time that the rabbit was Miriam Margolyes' voice and that Jan Ravens wasn't. So I don't know where I've got that from. I don't know if I just imagined that or something else, or if just Jan Ravens does a very good impression of the Caramel Bunny. But yeah, so it was always Miriam Margolyes, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
You're right. It would be weird to crush on a character played by someone you work with. Yeah. We're in a weird kind of a place in the jobs that we do, in that we do end up working with some really amazing people, but it also means that you often have to pack away crushes. It's like, I'll put that in a box and I'll get that out again after I've had to have a working relationship with you. Thank you very much.
Well, also, you're in that awful position, which I think it can be sort of be a bit messy, which is that, you know, when you're watching someone, especially sort of actors, what they're doing is they're playing a part. And I think I think it's absolutely fine to go, oh, of course, someone like, I don't know, you watch all of the assistants in Doctor Who are designed to be so cool and you want to be their best friend. And also, you know, because of the way that casting works, they're always, you know, played by attractive actresses most of the time, or actors. That then you go, oh yeah, of course, they're absolutely fancy all those people. But then you go like, oh no, but they are actors playing a role. And it's always very important that you can also go, yes, I understand how acting works, and this is, because otherwise, like you say, and I think actually ours is a job which completely sheds, you know, pulls back the curtain on that and allows you to realize that these are all, you know, these are people playing a part for a certain amount of time, and they're written by 9 people, and they're put in situations where they are tested, and therefore sort of shown all the best qualities of them are sort of shown up. So yeah, it's an interesting one where you can sort of meet people, and a lot of people are just nice people trying to get on with their lives. But what is attractive often is people who are dangerous, or, you know, sort of are fighting the good fight. And you know, that's what TV is about, but that's not what a lot of most people just want a quiet life, and that is fine. Basically, it's just a difference between fiction and reality. I could have said that, it would have been
Well, let's speak about fiction and reality for my last question to you, which is that if I produced a magic wand that could make any one of your 3 choices flesh and blood and bring them into the real world, who would you choose, and would you romantically pursue that person?
Interesting. Well, that's hard, because I wouldn't. The first two, I think, belong in their world, and that's like that's, you wouldn't want to ruin that, would you? Like, imagine taking someone who can be on Star Trek and saying, you have to live in Southeast London in 2021. If this magic wand can work both ways, and if you wave it and then I'm on a spaceship, then yeah, that is 100% what I would do. And I would take over the role and just be like the doting kind of puppy dog to this incredibly cool woman who wants to get in loads of danger. That is definitely who I do. If it was the other way around and it was taking someone who was a cartoon and bringing them to the real world, then I think Jane Lane, weirdly, I think she would prefer 2021 than she would to like the mid-90s. Because I think actually she might find a lot of the things that got her ridiculed or meant that she felt like an outsider in 2021. I mean, it's still a problem, and certainly there's still, you know, I'm not saying that everything is perfect, but there's maybe stuff like the internet might mean that she found a community quicker and actually became a bit of a hero of that community. And I wonder if someone like that, you know, part of me does wonder what she's doing now. Probably is incredibly successful and is still doing art of some kind, maybe like the head of a movie studio or something. But I kind of feel like if you took her at that age and put her now, I think Jane Lane would probably become some kind of like, you know, she'd be seen as like a god by by lots of people.
Yeah, I think she'd be like making, I think she'd be making like political art and selling it on Etsy and making a little living for herself and stuff.
She'd maybe have absolutely nailed, like, she might be like on TikTok, but doing something like telling people how they can, like, you know, their legal rights if they're arrested and stuff and doing all this.
Oh, God, thing. Yeah. She would absolutely be doing that and then making her own pins.
Yeah.
And like selling them as a side hustle. Yeah. I think she'd do well.
So I think that, yeah, that has to, I think as the kindest as well, because also Lana Kane cannot, don't think she'd function in the real world. I think
no, she wouldn't.
So, yeah,
well, that's brilliant.
This has been so much fun.
Oh, yeah. Well, before you go, are there any projects that you want to give a shout out about?
I sort of, everything that I do, I sort of I talk about on Twitter, which is at TNeenan on Twitter. Not this year, but at the end of 2022, there'll be more of my radio show, The Hauntening, coming out, which will be loads of fun. I need to actually write those.
That's always a pain, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, I wish it was just coming out.
I've been commissioned. I've got to write the fucking thing now.
It's the week-long period between... I mean, luckily, with Radio 4, it turns out that if you get commissioned, then they're like, but in, that's for 2025. So you get a long time to relax and ruminate in it. But yeah, I do actually need to think about what those are going to be. So yeah, those and, you know, various things which are cooking, but not yet out the oven, probably Twitter about.
Twitter about.
Exactly.
On Twitter. Tom, thank you ever so much.
Thank you. This has been so much fun.
Huge thanks to Tom Neenan. I'm Gabby Hutchinson Crouch. For more credits and details, see @curiously_drawn on Twitter.